introduction. Brent?
Thank you, David. I'm actually an employee of J.P. Morgan, and I have responsibility for the global agribusiness investment banking practice at J.P. Morgan, and part of that is the privilege of working the last 25 years with Cargill. Let me ask, just to kind of warm up everybody's mind on what we're going to talk about today, is how many of you at one point in your lives spent some or maybe more than some of your life on a farm? I mean, there must be 80 hands that go up. I just asked that question in a class at Duke University of 125 kids. Two hands went up. That shows what's happening in terms of our connection sometimes to our food. There are cards on your table, as you know, for questions. I'm going to start with a quiz question, and you can perhaps answer this question on your cards. I'm not going to give you the answer, so you're going to give me the answer. How many ears of corn are there on a typical corn plant? Well, some people are giving it away. I mean, it's too easy. It's the right answer. Okay. Greg has a unique worldview, a North Dakota boy who's become leader of one of the most phenomenal agribusiness companies in the world, an unmatched culture. I think Greg's perspective is also unique in his understanding of the interconnectedness of our food world and, to some extent, the energy world. But if you take the world's ag markets and you ask Greg a question, all you have to do is give him like one fact. Tell him what the price of a barrel of oil will be in the future, and he'll tell you what the prices will be for corn, bushel of corn, bushel of soybeans, what you'll pay for your steak next year, and whether you should go long or short sugar. And he can do that, and a lot more. So he's especially fun to talk to. He's going to talk about food security. Obviously, after he finishes, you'll appreciate, maybe more than you already do, the strategic nature of what food security has become on this globe and how it can lead to good things or regime change and bad things. I'll leave you with one last quiz question, and this one you might not have the answer to right away, so you can put this on your card too. And Greg will give the answer to this at the end of his speech. If there was one bushel of corn left in the world, and the world's going to come to an end, so you can't give me seed corn as the answer. There's one bushel of corn left in the world. What's the highest margin use of that last bushel of corn? Greg?
Now I'm going to spend the next 30 minutes thinking about what the answer is. It's a great question. Good afternoon. It's great to be with everyone here in Florida. I must confess that compared to a typical winter, the temperature arbitrage between Minneapolis and Florida is not that big this year, but nonetheless, it's wonderful to be here on the Gulf Coast. As Britt talked about those 125 Duke students and two students raising their hand, having been on a farm, the thought that came to my mind is the stark realization for companies like Cargill is it's the other 123 that have the strongest opinions about how we ought to feed ourselves. And amen. And so that, in that regard, that is the great task for food and agriculture, and we'll talk about some examples of the importance of the how we're going to go about feeding ourselves. So first, just 1 minute on Cargill. Many people in the room, I know certainly a lot of Minnesotans know Cargill, but 147-year-old family-owned company, started in Conover, Iowa in 1865. Today we do business in 65 countries around the world. A little more than two-thirds of all of our employees live and work outside of the United States. And that proportion has continued to grow as the proportion of the world's wealth that exists outside the United States has continued to grow. So I'm going to talk about a number of subjects. Some of them were captured last Friday. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal, short 400-word article, and the title of it, Shortage Scrambles Eastern Europe Egg Hunt. And it was an article that captures many of the things that I had intended to say in a single article. And the point in talking about it is the debate about how and where we're going to feed ourselves is increasingly being shaped by the media. And it's a strange place for people in agriculture, certainly a private company like Cargill. It's been an industry that's been in the background and somewhat ignored for more than 30 years, and now with the advent of price increases and things, there has been increased interest. But I would have said the quality of that media coverage has been mixed, and in some cases because of a lack of context. So out of this article, I pulled just a few things. One, this year, coinciding with the drop in supply, as farmers adjust to the new EU requirements mandating bigger cages for laying hens, the result has been soaring prices. Who'd have thought? So the next part of the article goes on to say, the price has gone up a lot, so I am buying less, said Jana Patakova, 26 years old, mother of four. Who'd have thought? Right? As things get more expensive, do people make decisions that impact demand in a negative way? The next one is one that we deal with quite often, which is the hyperbole that surrounds it. Central bankers are keeping a watchful eye. This is in the Wall Street Journal. You can't make it up, right? So central bankers are keeping a watchful eye on egg prices, which have been contributing to inflationary pressures that are making it harder for monetary authorities to cut interest rates despite anemic European growth. You all thought it was the Greeks, right? You heard it here. The next one. The price jump in the Czech Republic is more than double that in Poland, which hasn't complied with the new rules. Okay, arbitrage. I like it. They go on to say that the value of Easter is therefore much higher in Czechoslovakia, but it's been exacerbated by the hoarding impulses from the days of central planning. And certainly one of the things I'll try to make a point on today is the advent of hoarding. And certainly with the internet and 24/7 news, the way in which people react either in a very complacent manner or react as if there's a crisis to food messages has changed dramatically, and with it, the volatility. And finally, my favorite is Marek Sawicki, who is the Deputy Minister of Agriculture in Poland, made the observation, it's not the roosters who will pay for the upgrade of the cages. Okay. So as you think about changes in how we produce our food, bear in mind the roosters or whatever are very unlikely to bear the burden. And so hopefully I'll make some points that are supportive of this idea of hyperbole, the idea of the impact of price both on demand and on supply, and the whole issue of the how of the global food system. Six broad subjects. Talk first about fear of famine. There shouldn't be any. The second about prices and the way in which they shape and drive almost everything else in agriculture. Third, the convergence of food and energy, and Britt referred to that in his opening remarks. It has been an enormous factor in our space, and it's going to continue to be. The fourth is one that gets a lot of coverage, is the issue of organics, and on the other side of that debate, the use of genetically modified organisms. The fifth, I'll talk just for a minute about obesity and the fact that this really is a simpler issue than we think it is, and that the whole concept of delayed gratification continues to elude us. And the sixth one is around food safety, and parenthetically, it's really around trust in the people that govern the way in which our food is produced and delivered to us. And in that case, I think this is a much more difficult issue than we often think about it and the attention that we accord it. So my disclaimer is there are two. One, I believe that 90% of what I will tell you is the truth. And ...91% tops, right? So. And the second is, I will attempt not to give you a blizzard of facts and factoids, but I think there are a very small subset of facts that should underpin all of the discussion, and certainly we'll try to share those with you. So the first one, famine. We have fed ourselves to this date, and we can feed ourselves going forward. About this, I have absolutely no doubt, provided we make good decisions. The world has doubled the amount of food it produces since 1975 and done it basically with the same amount of land that we used in 1975. What's going to change going forward is we need to double food production again by 2050, and to do that, our best guess is that we need about 20% more acres. So a small increase in the amount of acres, and I left a map on all of your chairs to remind people of how truly big Africa is. And we probably can't do that in an environmentally sustainable way if we do not include Africa in the solution to raising the calories that the world needs. So the issue of famine, the headline number in most articles is there are 1 billion hungry people in the world. You have to keep in mind half of those people are said to be in China, which has $2.5 trillion, so there may be another group of people that should address that challenge. And in India, who will be a significant net food exporter this year. So the whole issue of famine is an enormously complicated one when you consider that arguably 40%+ of the undernourished people in the world are in countries that have either the financial wherewithal or the agricultural wherewithal to address that. A couple other things to keep in mind. There's a lot of conversation that the globalization of food is one of the causes of this fear of famine in the lack of food security. In point of fact, for a long time, the statistic has stayed fairly flat. 85% of all the calories consumed in the world are grown in the nation where they're consumed. And so less than 15% of all the calories consumed in the world go across international borders. Clearly, those 15% are really important if you live in Saudi Arabia. But the fact remains, it is a highly local business, but to have a very sound sort of trust-based trade policies that support those other 15% of the calories is important. The last point I would make is about comparative advantage. Is over and over I meet with government officials who are bound and determined to define food security as self-sufficiency. And if you think about the soil and the climate and the rainfall patterns, the very idea that every country could be uniquely food self-sufficient is only going to lead to insecurity for all of us. And so the idea of exploiting comparative advantage, I think it's really a good deal that Minnesota buys orange juice from Florida. It's probably a fairly sound decision, and that same logic needs to be extended forward. The next one is around price. That most articles that are written in the media, price is talked about as a harbinger of inflation, and you need to think about it as much more. It is a signal to producers to change their behavior, and certainly all over the world today, we see an enormous response from a supply standpoint to the price signals that are coming out. And I think, assuming we get normalized weather at some point, that the world will observe the powerful impact on price of getting farmers to change their behavior and to grow more food. Second thing about price is to put it in context of global GDP. In 1975, about 3.5% of global GDP was represented by the farm gate value of all the important food crops: oil seeds, corn, rice, wheat. You can go through the list, palm oil. That number fell to below 1%. So we had nearly a 70% reduction from 1975 to 2006 in the proportion of global GDP represented by the value of foodstuffs, basic foodstuffs. It shrank to less than 1% of GDP. Is that the sense you would get from reading your newspaper? 99% of the rest of the definition of our well-being excludes the farm gate value of the foodstuffs that are the building blocks. And so what we're really dealing with is a very important issue and a very emotional issue, but it needs to be put in perspective. The second thing about price that's changed dramatically, and the first thing I would say is I don't believe it's being caused by speculators in the conventional sense, although legislation is still being debated that takes the opposite view. For a long time and to this date, year to year, the variation between production and the expected production is plus or minus 2.5%. And so it's always wiggled. The weather changes. You expect something, you get 2.5% more. You get good weather, you get 2.5% less. But on a global basis, the number of calories we produce only changed a couple of percent. What has changed is today that 2% change one way or the other is making prices move closer to 50%, which is far, far more dramatic than it's ever been in the past, which comes to the issue from the Wall Street Journal story about hoarding. And hoarding is clearly something that has started taking place, triggered by anxiety. And what happens is people read an article, and even at an individual level, we can see it in the patterns of purchase from Cargill. People start to hoard in thousands of small ways, whether it's a restaurant that buys 2 weeks worth of vegetable oil for their fryer in advance, but you multiply it by tens of millions of households, and pretty soon we see enormous swings. In the fall of 2008, we saw 40% declines in the demand for many of our food staples for about 2 months as people emptied their larders. And you get this free fall, and all of a sudden you speculate. No, it's lots of people with two bags of rice in the basement shelf. I think the second one about price is the whole issue of what McKinsey calls pricing the world. And I say the canary in the mine for food is, if we need to grow food in eastern Kazakhstan, you'll know we're under pressure. And if you think about it, we will always grow food in the Pampas, we'll always grow food in southern Illinois, because those are the great places that people have grown food for so long, the Black Sea, and you can go on and on. But as we put more pressure on our system, you can almost measure that pressure, not so much by the price as by the where we're going to go about feeding ourselves. Third one was food and energy convergence. In the other side of your map of Africa is a handout. 8% of all the grain in the world is converted into fuel, and about 14% of the world's vegetable oil. So to put that in context, if you take those 1 billion hungry people and take the number of calories by which they're undernourished, it adds up to about 32 to 33 million tons of grain and oil foods to extinguish that caloric gap that exists. And these are the United Nations' own numbers. So to put that in context, that's about 1.5% of the world's grain. So we're making 8% of our grain and 14% of our oil seeds into fuel, and our undernourishment gap is less than 1.5%. And so mathematically, we have an overwhelming capacity today to extinguish that famine gap or that nourishment gap, and it hasn't happened. The second thing on food and energy convergence, which is a good thing, is the prices it stimulated have caused agriculture around the world to be recapitalized. And everywhere I travel, the number of John Deere tractors, you see new ones going down the road, the amount of money that's being invested in infrastructure is awesome. And in that regard, the convergence of food and fuel has been the impetus for a wonderful recapitalization of the ability of the world to grow more calories. We just happen to have elected to use it to make fuel at this moment. Organics and GMOs. So first on organics, I won't speak my own number, but Norman Borlaug, who I think put more time and science into this, says arguably the most people we could feed on the world organically is 4 billion. And so I believe that to be a correct observation. My own farm in Iowa was farmed up until this year for the last 6 or 7 years organically. It was horrifying to watch. As the guy tilled the farm 5 or 6 times to control weeds, burning diesel fuel, driving 200 miles to gather enough manure to nourish his crops, burning diesel fuel to haul it back, and you go on and on. I have no idea what the carbon footprint was, but it had to be some many multiples of a more conventional approach to growing the calories that we need. In the issue of GMOs, I think the important thing is there are those who say we can't feed ourselves without GMOs. It's not correct. We could feed ourselves and not use that technology. We just shouldn't. We should use that technology because you use far less diesel fuel, you use far less water, and you use dramatically fewer chemicals. And we, as agriculture, have been very, very weak in conveying that message to people. They shouldn't be afraid to feed ourselves without GMOs. We just shouldn't do it. The next one is on obesity. And I'll be quick because we need to save a few minutes for questions. Since 1990, the number of Americans whose body mass index is greater than 30 has tripled. How many of you think it's because we've eaten more food? Only a couple hands. I wouldn't ask if that was the right answer, right? It is. The total quantity of meat per capita in the United States has gone down since 1990, and the shift from red meat to white meat has been dramatic. The number of grams of trans fat consumed by Americans has fallen almost 75% since 1990. The number of pounds of flour consumed per American has gone down by more than 12 pounds per person per year. in the total consumption of all sweeteners, so we don't get into arguments about corn syrup and sugar or honey, so we take all caloric sweeteners, has fallen as well. So in the advent of a decline in the per capita consumptions of all of the major caloric food groups, obesity has tripled. And so we do need to address the other side of the equation. There's a great study that was done by a guy that went back and looked at, well, what's changed about our activity levels? Went back into the mid-1960s. And took things like, you had to get out of your car to close your own garage door. Horror of horrors, you had to roll down your own window. You had to rotary dial the phone. Caloric. Anyway, the guy must have had a lot of free time on his hands, but 111 calories a day. Okay, out of 2,000. But all those little things. One was drying your own dishes. So looking to some of the spouses out there, there's an idea right there. Do your own dishes and save 3 pounds. And so it is a 3-pound issue. And so in that context that we do have to address it, it was scary to me 2 weeks ago, Kathleen Sebelius, the Health and Human Services person, came out and headline story, critical to childhood obesity is reducing daily caloric intake, 64 calories a day. Walk around the house twice. You know? And so the whole issue about about exercise and intake is a discussion that we've been unwilling to have. And I thought, since I'm in Florida and 5 o'clock does arrive here, that I need to talk about green olives. And not to take all the fun out of it, but one green olive a day can change nothing else in your life. Exercise or other food consumptions is 5 pounds a year. So, the people in our labs are working on a non-caloric olive. No. But besides that, I've had the chance to speak with a lot of legislators, and there's a big talk about a soda tax, and I usually start out by saying, I'm prepared to consider a soda tax if it includes olives and their head tips. But the issue is not to demonize a specific source of calories, but to think about it in the context of all the others. So food safety and trust, and then I'll close. How many of you would like to know everything about today's meal? One. All right, I'll send you a book. So we have some people with time on their hands, evidently, at Cargill. So we took, there was some legislation conceived in California about the right to know, about transparency around food. And so we had some people just take a cheeseburger and say, to comply with the California law as they envisioned it might ultimately come out, what would be required in terms of disclosure? 450 pages. Because you need to describe the process for making cheese, the whole thing around the way the yeast was created for the bun, and on and on. And so I think we have to find a spot where we can earn and receive people's trust about the how of their food, and at the same time stop short of this total disclosure, which is sometimes used to disparage certain kinds of food. The other comment I was going to make many times, most of the time, okay, all the time, when my wife and I are going out to dinner, she said, Greg, don't explain the food. And then on Monday morning, I go to work, and our public affairs people say, Greg, we need you to get out there and explain the food. And so I'm living a world between two sets of instruction. So I'll make one other comment in that regard. How many of you have seen the articles around pink slime? Okay. Well, only 2 out of 125 dookies have ever been on a farm, but everybody's heard about pink slime. And certainly, it has impacted us. It has enormously impacted American ranchers to the tune of billions of dollars in the price decreases that have come on since then. And it's a great example of how we have to get out there in a transparent and effective way to deal both with the science and with the emotion. But the example I'd like to do to enlist all of you, if we take a filet mignon, a tenderloin, the most expensive piece of beef, and we put it into this very process that we have, what comes out of that will be a filet mignon with 8% less fat. But it is no less flame and bone because it went through that process. And the same thing is true for all of the other beef that's included in those products. So it's as simple as it is beef. And we as an industry clearly have failed the ranchers that we represent in the ability to explain that and to get people to be comfortable with it. So a great reminder to all of us that deal with trust building every day to get on with it. So the answer to the question posed to you by Britt Garter is? I thought you, oh, the ear of corn, yeah, is one. Okay, but somebody yelled it out. And the second word, what will the last, what is the highest marginal value use of a bushel of corn? Popcorn?
Popcorn.
Peck? Come on. Jack Daniels. It's like so many other truths. They're self-evident after the fact. So, to close, very positive. We can, we will feed ourselves. We can do it with rainfall. We can do it in a responsible and renewable way. We just have to make all those thousands of interdependent decisions that allow that to happen. That we need to view price as not just a harbinger of inflation, but as the way in which we signal the kinds of behaviors that we want to have happen. And we need to realize that every one of the decisions in the food system are going to have huge second and third order consequences for everyone. So appreciate the time and look forward to the questions that you've submitted. Thank you.
One quick question. If you look at exporting of commodities from the United States to other countries, how much does that help our balance payments?
Oh.
It has to.
I've been clear with these prices. It's helped us enormously. I don't have the exact number. We export about 12% of our corn, probably more than a third of our soybeans, and depending on the crop, 40% of our wheat. So it's a big deal.
Okay. We have two gifts for you. First, a book contributed by one of our members. It's a book on Marco Island. And next, we have a book for you on Naples, Florida. And we'd like you to take those back and enjoy reading them about.
Okay.
And hopefully remembering a good trip to Naples, Florida. Okay. We have one other great benefit for you as a speaker. We hope you avail yourself of this benefit. I mentioned 387 on the wait list. If you'd like to become a member, you immediately jump to the head of the wait list. And please do that because we need your money to keep affording doing scholarships like you were here to witness today. Again, thank you, and I'll keep you from
it. Thank you. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Dave. Well, we got some great questions here. Thank you all for shooting them in. First, just a quick one, Greg. This is from a city boy, he says. He would like you to explain what are GMOs. So we used an abbreviation, so you need to kind of...
So genetically modified organisms is a plant breeding technology that allows us to breed proteins into plants that make them resistant to certain herbicides, and it allows us to control weeds after the plant has emerged, and has a much more cost-effective and a much more environmentally sensitive way to do it.
Right, and actually that one ear of corn, if you'll notice, it appears on the plant at more or less the same height on every plant. That's not by accident. That's so the harvester can find it, and that's been bred in. Okay. These are three questions all on the same topic.
No.
Should the federal government, in one way or another, these questions are all the same, should the federal government continue to subsidize farming?
The cargo coached answer is no. At the same time, I make further comment. One, the degree of it has fallen dramatically as prices have risen, and most of the crops grown in the U.S. today do not require price subsidization or support from the government. The one area where I believe that it has been cost-effective and appropriate for the government to have a farm policy is around crop insurance, which has allowed people to comfortably deploy the best technology to invest in the future of their own farms and to do it with some degree of insurance protection that's afforded by those programs.
And we certainly did a lot for farmers from 1930 to the present with subsidies. You may not need as much anymore, that's for sure. This is perhaps the topic as at least as controversial as pink slime, and certainly a lot more has been written and spoken about. How can anyone make an economic underlying argument for ethanol?
The floor is open. No, in my comments, I attempted to address it, and it goes back to the issue of price. What is confronting all of us is the more is better mindset that often sits into any of these programs. And appropriately sized, it is a way to protect farmers from a total collapse in the revenue that's coming to them in the years that the trend above the line. And in that regard, I think it keeps capital flowing, it keeps rural communities vibrant. The great challenge has become, it worked well at 3%, it worked well at 4%, it worked well at 6%, and there is a tipping point where, because it's totally inelastic demand, it has an outsized impact on price. And so the issue isn't about going back to zero. Remember, we use 180 million tons of corn just to make ethanol, corn and wheat to make ethanol. It only takes 35 million tons to make up all the calorie deficiency of all those people. We could still have an interesting size renewable fuels business optimizing our agricultural resources and our rainfall. We just have to size it correctly so that we don't undernourish for that 35 million tons that I think most of us feel could be more smartly deployed.
Great question from a student. In terms of global food security, what should be done about foreign aid to Africa? Where should it be directed, and should we eliminate it or grow it?
Well, we have to pull those acres into the global system. It's clearly going to take an enormous amount of capital to do it. The world has spent literally hundreds of billions of dollars in Africa over the last 40 years, and we have nothing in terms of productive small farmers to show for it. And so the model of the last 40 years has to be rethought. Cargill is trying hard to be part of that rethinking. Adam Smith is not as popular in Africa as you'd think he should be. And so we think that there need to be some market-based solutions supported by multilateral institutions like the World Bank. And we need their acres, but we need to do it thoughtfully.
Another very thoughtful question from a student, and reflects, I think, a very good understanding of some of the things you've already mentioned. But you've said the main issue is not in global hunger, a lack of food, but the lack of effective distribution. And so speak about how we can improve the means internationally of getting food to where it's actually needs to be eaten, and avoiding the loss of shrinkage. And what are the obstacles in terms of infrastructure?
I think the biggest one is income. I don't think there are places clearly trying to help people in Somalia is incredibly difficult at this moment. And so we have people that are hungry because of civil strife, South Sudan. Setting those aside, the issue is really about capacity to pay. And that if the income is there, capitalism is a powerful thing. If there is demand that has money, supply will find it. And so I believe, not that infrastructure isn't important in lowering the cost of getting the food there, but I think the first and foremost thing is to think about the economic side of the demand.
This next one refers to a book I hope you've all read, The Hunger Games. Could The Hunger Games become reality in terms of the world, in terms of regime change and chaos, and how do we avoid it? Obviously, you touched on free trade as one of those issues.
I haven't seen the movie, so I don't know. It doesn't need to happen, I think, is the more important question. But certainly, the impact of government decisions and the second and third order consequences compounded over multiple years should sober us. So if the movie causes people to be more thoughtful about the issue, then I think it's a good thing that it's happened. But it need not occur, in my opinion. Absolutely not necessary.
On the topic of sweeteners, obviously every time we invent a new sweetener, it's 100 times more sweet than the last one. And what's the sort of direction this question wants to know? What's the next step in artificial sweeteners?
This is Britt's own question. We continue to work on it. Clearly, taking calories out of the diet and doing it with an all-natural product is something that people want to do. I was disappointed today, and I'll send a supply to the hotel of Truvia, the first all-natural, non-caloric sweetener from Cargill. And so we continue to work on other alternatives. And hopefully, it's like introducing a new pharmaceutical almost. To go through all of the FDA certification to introduce a new food ingredient, a food ingredient takes 6 or 7 years and tens of millions of dollars, but we hope to be in the market by 2014.
David? I think we pretty much covered all the questions. Is there anyone else want to raise one from the floor?
Okay. Greg, again, I want to thank you. Thanks to all you for coming this year. We'll see you November 16th will be our next meeting. Thank you. Be sure and turn in your name badge.